Sounds True presents Mantra, Sacred Words of Power, Session 3, Karma and Mantras.
I am often asked if one needs to change religion to use Sanskrit mantras. The answer is an emphatic no. In my experience, I've lived with people of varying faiths, including Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, Christianity, and Hinduism. All of them used Sanskrit mantra and found no conflict with their faith, because Sanskrit mantra is not about religion so much as it is about spiritual energy that transcends religion and is common to the human condition. The various anthropomorphized principles that represent the Hindu pantheon, say, have really evolved over time as aids to learning and working with the energy-based language. They put visual and conceptual components with the energy base. They also have art and music, literature, painting, and sculpture to also assist in producing an understanding of this essentially energy-based phenomenon. And it is all of these appurtenances that have come to be known as Hinduism. Technically speaking, there is no single religion that is Hinduism, but it is a collection of a number of philosophies and approaches that have come under one term. So the short answer is no. There are certainly images that we borrow from what has evolved to be Hinduism over thousands of years, but one certainly need not change their tradition to work with these energy-based sounds. The other important point to know is that mantras will work whether you believe in them or not. This is not a function of belief. I tell people it's similar to going up to the top of a building and saying, "I will not be harmed, I will not be harmed," and jumping off the building. The law of gravity is going to inexorably come into play, and something will happen. And when working with Sanskrit mantra, we are working with spiritual laws that come into play whether or not we believe in them. They perform their energy-based function, and they will have an effect regardless of whether we look at Durga or Saraswati or Ganesha. There will be an effect because they are energy-based. So with that in mind, there are seven things I'd like you to remember about mantras, and the first of which is that they are energy-based rather than meaning-based. Pronouncing a mantra creates a particular physical vibration in the form of sound. This sound produces an actual effect in the physical body and in a subtle body. And the effects of the energy come to be recognized within the body as the meaning, but they have nothing to do with meaning as we understand them. In the same context, number two, mantras have only an approximate language-based translation. Here's what I mean. If we tell a young child not to touch a hot stove, we're trying to explain to the child that it's hot and the child may become burned. However, the child has no experience to support what we're trying to tell them. Only if the child actually touches the stove, becomes burned, then they'll know what hot means, because it has an energy context associated with it. And they now understand hot in the context of burn and in the context of stove. It's the same with mantras. The only true definition is the experience which a mantra ultimately creates in the individual who chants it, who uses it. The original seer of the mantra understood its effect in a specific way. And remarkably, down through the thousands and thousands of years, whether it was said then or said now, the outcomes are remarkably similar because the energy is the same. That's not to say that the Sanskrit language is a meaningless language in terms of communication. It certainly is not. But it is stylized because it is dependent first upon energy and second upon meaning, as opposed to English, which is first upon meaning and second upon energy. The third thing is that mantras are also chakra-based sounds. Now, we've talked about chakras as those energy centers located along the spine. Each of them are like flowers, those chakras, and the flowers have different numbers of petals. And if you add up all of the petals on chakras 1 through 6, there's a total of 50 of them. And interestingly enough, there are exactly 50 letters in the Sanskrit alphabet. And according to the teachers in India, they will tell you that the developed clairvoyant adept can actually see the petals on the chakras. And long ago, they were recorded and written down. And that's how we have the record today of which Sanskrit letters are in which petals of which chakras. So that as you chant the Sanskrit language, you are resonating the petals of those chakras in a scientific, systematized way that composes the words of the mantras. In this way, mantra affects our physical body because of the energy in our subtle body, and therefore it affects our spiritual consciousness as the energy continues to grow through our chanting of the mantra. 4, mantras combined with your attention produces a more powerful outcome. There's a saying in spiritual circles you may have heard, attention is energy. Intention qualifies attention. It's as if you have a white light bulb, which is raw light energy. You put a red gel in front of it, you put a green gel in front of it, you're going to change the quality of the light, but the light is still the same. Similarly, if you change the intention, you're going to affect subtle shades of the mantra. In any case, you're going to make it more powerful because you're taking the sound vibration itself and combining it with the mental quality of your intention. And this strengthens and directs the quality of the energy and makes it even more powerful. In a sense, you've combined mind and sound into a very powerful tool. 5, mantra energizes prana. There is a form of life energy in the body called prana. People who do hands-on healing work with the prana. Sometimes they can help clear pranic blockages in another person, and sometimes they can transfer their own prana. In fact, the sciences of acupuncture and acupressure work on the idea of the circulation of prana within the subtle body. Mantra energizes prana. It brings ambient energy from the near surround into the prana. By pronouncing a particular mantra while visualizing an internal organ, you can concentrate prana in that organ and start to perform healing on yourself. You can increase the circulation of life energy in your body by chanting your mantra and seeing the energy of your body brightly and uniformly distributed throughout your body. In this case, your mental intention combined with the sound can work in a very specific way. 6. Mantras are energy which can be likened to fire. You know, there's an old saying that you can take fire and you can use it to cook your lunch, or you can burn down the forest. It's the same fire. Fire is fire. Something is similarly true with mantras. Mantras evoke powerful energies that should be treated with respect. So if you're using your mantra with intensity and discipline and focus, and you find that maybe your behavior is not quite what you want it to be, you're a little irritable, you're a little on edge, take a break. Let your fire cool down a little bit, and then go back and pick it up again when things are manageable. You're working with tangible energy, respect it, and respect its activity within you. 7, mantras eventually quiet the mind. Over a period of time, as we talked about in an earlier session, the subconscious waves of thought that exist throughout the body become absorbed and quieted by the power of the mantra so that you become peaceful over time. Now, that's one part of the phenomenon. Sometimes, however, while we're digging up highly crystallized patterns, It can be disconcerting. Let me give you an example. Suppose you have a swimming pool, and on the bottom of this swimming pool, there's accumulated a couple of inches of muck that have gathered over several years, and you want to clean the muck out of that pool. So you lower a vacuum hose into the muck and you turn on the switch. What happens? The first thing, all the muck swirls up, even as some is pulled into the hose. So in looking at it from the outside, it looks as if the pool is actually getting dirtier. In fact, it's not true. You've stirred up the muck even while you're cleaning it. Sometimes you'll find as you're chanting mantra that your state of clarity will become temporarily clouded, and you might find that your energy, rather than being peaceful and serene, becomes a little agitated. Please know that you're in fact cleaning out stuff, and as we talked about earlier, it's just working its way out. So summarizing the seven things I'd like you to remember about mantras. First, they are energy-based sounds. Second, they have only an approximate language-based translation, even if it is part of a language that is used to communicate. Three, they are chakra-based sounds. Four, when you combine mantra with mental intention, you increase their effect. Five, mantra can energize your prana. Six, mantras are energy like fire, so respect them. And seven, mantras eventually quiet the mind, even if you should disrupt little crystallized patterns for a while. Eventually, they will clean your entire subconscious, and you will become a repository of peace. Words become popular and circulate sometimes as slang. We have some Sanskrit words that fit in that category. Guru, mantra, karma. It's that last word I'd like to talk a bit about. What is karma anyway? Well, understanding karma will help us better understand the activity of Sanskrit mantra, what it's working on and how it works. Simply stated, karma is the law of cause and effect. As the doctrine states, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. But the nature of karma says, we may have sown in a previous lifetime and be reaping in this lifetime. Because karma rests upon the idea of reincarnation, or past lives in which karma has been created. In a classical sense, karma is all of the thoughts and the words and the deeds we have ever created since we took first birth upon this earth, however many lifetimes ago that may be. And, correspondingly, you can have good karma just as easily as you can have bad karma. Now, most of us are trying to work out the stuff that's not too good. But another saying from the East is, a gold chain will bind you just as firmly as an iron one. Ultimately, we must be free of both kinds of karma, both good and bad, if we are to achieve that state called mukti, or liberation, that we talked about earlier. We don't want anything that will bind us here. We want to graduate so we can go on to other things. Most of us, however, are working trying to eliminate karma that we've created in other lives, which may not be what we wish. If we, for instance, don't have the amount of income or job that we might want, then we have karma that is associated with that. If you are not getting the kind of relationship you want, then our karma from past life is influencing that as well. And mantras can help us with both of these and other things. The law of karma also includes the idea of grace. Our karma can be forgiven by some form of divine authority. And this can take several forms. In the New Testament, we read where Jesus was to have taken on the collective sins of humanity, and most of us are familiar with that idea from that source. But it's not just limited to the great ones around whom world religions have formed. The great sage Paramahamsa Yogananda once visited a place in India where elephantiasis was widespread. And soon he began to exhibit all the symptoms of elephantiasis. And someone asked him, they said, well, Master Yogananda, you have all of these things. Have you contracted the disease? He said, no, I'm just doing my part. And he dropped it at that. And those who understood knew that he was taking on part of that disease on himself to relieve the general suffering. He took on as much as he could handle as his way of serving those in the community where he was living. I once had a personal example of a spiritual teacher I complained to about a problem that I had. And he looked at me and he said, "Okay, let me have it." And I felt something lift within, and he seemed to sag a little. And then he seemed to shrug his shoulders, and he said out loud, "It's just the body. I am not this body anyway." And from that moment on, that which had been bothering me no longer bothered me. And so here we have an example, not of great religious figures that we know from religious literature, but figures much less famous. Yogananda is very famous. The individual that I talked to was very little known, but he had the power to take other people's karma and work it off in a spirit of service. Like many of you, many years ago, I came across the phenomenon of a Catholic priest known as Padre Pio and the phenomenon of the stigmata. For those of you who may not have run into this, the stigmata is where an individual will begin to demonstrate the wounds of Christ on their person. Padre Pio is an example of that, where he had the nail wounds in his hand and he used to bleed. He was examined by doctors and scientists for years, and they could never find anything that would suggest that it was a fraud. It was obviously happening to him, but no one knew how it was happening to him. There have also been nuns who have had the stigmata. And one theory that has been offered is that these people, out of their devotion to Christ, had undertaken a tiny piece of his suffering, and that their devotion had qualified them to take that piece. And some have even suggested that there were so many throughout history that have done that, that Christ actually experienced very little pain when he was actually on the cross, because so many people had decided that they wanted to share in his passion. To understand some of the methods related to Sanskrit mantra and the relief of karma, we should understand that there are four divisions of karma that are described in the Vedas. They have Sanskrit names. One is called Sanchita karma. That just means all the past accumulated actions from all of our lifetimes. Number two is called Prarabdha karma. Prarabdha karma is that portion of our total karma that we have decided to give ourselves an opportunity to work off in this particular individual lifetime. And it is that kind of karma that we are most concerned with. What did we come in with? What kinds of karma do we have to work with? And what can we do about it? The third kind is called agami karma, and that is the result from actions in this lifetime that will affect future lifetimes. Now we begin to understand the Buddhist idea of right livelihood and the Ten Commandments or the Golden Rule. Because if we follow those prescriptions from those religions, we are producing good karma for our next life and not producing more bad karma. So these dictums then become really instructions in enlightened self-interest so that we can improve the fruits of future lives. There's one fourth kind that I should talk about, which is Kriyamana karma. That's instant karma. You hit somebody, chances are they're going to hit you back. They call that Kriyamana karma. Now, there's another aspect that we need to consider, which is storing of karma. We have a physical body. You know, all of us have different kinds of physical bodies. Some have great athletic talent. Some have great musical skill. We have mathematical geniuses. We have people that have good luck playing the ponies. All of this has to do with the kinds of energy, both physical and mental, that we bring in with us when we come into embodiment. Since we come in with all these various karmic predispositions in our physical organs, in our emotional life, in our mental life, then how do these individual bits of karma come into play? The answer is they are triggered. We meet a person in a certain set of circumstances which triggers some reactive pattern, triggers some form of action, and immediately our karma comes into play. How we work and handle these things determines how much of the karma we work off and how much of it we may create anew and have to work off at some future time. So on the one hand, while the law of karma is very simple, as you sow, so shall you reap. What goes around comes around. The law of cause and effect. Simple statement, complex outworking. Let's say, for instance, that someone is fired from a job or contracts a serious illness, or maybe loses a lover. Each person will react differently. While one person may become depressed or discouraged, another, when facing these circumstances, decides that they will never give up. They become even more determined. So how we handle life circumstances determines how we handle our own karma, both present and future. So now that we know that we have karma, we have different kinds of karma, that we store karma, how is it we work it off? What can we do to work it off? Well, the way I'm familiar with is Sanskrit mantra. By working with mantras, you begin to dig up karma and neutralize it from within, depending upon the formula. There are some Sanskrit mantras that work on specific conditions. For instance, the mantra Om Shri Mahalakshmiyeh Namaha, a mantra to bring in abundance. Well, this is a fairly specific application of mantra. There are other classes of mantra that are for spiritual development, spiritual growth, and will begin to move the entire organism forward without addressing any specific problem. There are mantras in Buddhism and mantras in Hinduism that do that. Some of them we'll talk about later, but to give you an example, the Buddhist mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Is a mantra that advances one spiritually. It does not address an individual problem or difficulty. It is a spiritual mantra that takes the entire organism and moves it forward. Well, that's fine, and we should all say mantras that do that. But the truth is, we're also concerned with life on this plane, in the body, and the difficulties it presents. The kind of work we do spiritually can determine how our karma works. American Swami Kriyananda, known more recently as Donald Walters, made a beautiful statement. He said, it can be in your karma that you're supposed to fall down a flight of stairs and break your leg at a certain point. But through use of spiritual discipline, you can prepare yourself so that when that moment comes, all you do is stub your toe. This is a beautiful example of how spiritual work can reduce and lessen even the most difficult kinds of karma. One of the ways in which karma works powerfully for all of us is in the position of the planets. The science of astrology is thousands of years old, and there is an Eastern variety and a Western variety. And in my experience, both of them appear to work and have a scientific validity and a basis. But only the Eastern approach to astrology has specific mantras for each of the planets, so that if you're having problem with a vibration from one planet or another that's manifesting in difficulties in your daily life, you can soften that, and in some cases, eliminate it altogether. So there are mantras for each of the planets and two nodes of the moon called Dragon's Head and Dragon's Tail that astrologers know well. Working with these mantras by chanting them works directly upon the organ inside where the karma relating to that planet is stored. It begins to dig out that which may be holding you back and releasing it, so that any negative effects from that planetary influence simply evaporates. So if you're seriously concerned with reducing your karma that is related to the position of the planets, I would highly recommend that you find a competent astrologer, either of the Eastern or the Western variety, and have your horoscope cast. Once you have that in your hand, the astrologer will tell you what are the difficult alignments in your chart. And those alignments are governed by planets and the way they relate to one another. Once you know what the planets are, you can chant mantras relating specifically to those planets. Now let me go down the mantras for the seven planets and the two karmic nodes of the moon. And you'll be able to refer to this once you get your astrological horoscope cast. If, for instance, an astrologer tells you that you have a problem with the way the sun relates to some of the planets that may be causing you difficulties, then I would suggest that you chant a sun mantra that will alleviate that problem. And the mantra for the sun in Sanskrit, the short form, is Om Suryaya Namaha. Om Suryaya Namaha. Om Suryaya Namaha. Sometimes a chart may reveal that there is a problem with the moon placement, and the moon generally accounts for the way a personality may present itself to the world. So if you want to work with that, Om Chandraya Namaha is a powerful mantra for the moon. Om Chandraya Namaha. Om Chandraya Namaha. For some people, the planet Mars can cause problems related to aggression or problems related to even injury because of its nature. So there is a mantra that will soften that as well. This mantra is a little bit longer and a little bit more complicated, but I think you can get it. Om Angarakaya Namaha. Om Angarakaya Namaha. Om Angarakaya Namaha. Now remember, all of these mantras are included in the workbook that comes with this course, so you can always refer to that even as you're listening to this. Mercury, communications, the messenger, has a mantra that is somewhat familiar because it's Buddha, not the Buddha, but Buddha. Om Buddhaya Namaha. Om Buddhaya Namaha. Om Buddhaya Namaha. Jupiter, the planet of the great benefactor, if it's held in a position where it's not able to give you all of the things that you may need or want, then chant this mantra to bring forth its pleasant and generous qualities. Om Gurave Namaha. Om Gurave Namaha. Om Gurave Namaha. Venus, we know it as the planet of love. In the Eastern school, it is also the planet of scriptural knowledge, for those who want to understand the inner meaning of the scriptures. And the mantra for it is, Om Shukraya Namaha. Om Shukraya Namaha. Om Shukraya Namaha. Saturn is the planet of lessons. Oh boy. I've heard so many stories of people that are in what astrologers call their Saturn cycle, and their life turns upside down. Well, there's a mantra that I have used in my own Saturn cycle that helped me greatly. I'm going to give you two forms of the mantra, one to use if you're before the age of 28, and another one if you are after the age of 28. Because at the age of 28, your Saturn return begins. That is to say, that Saturn returns to the point it was when you were born in its orbit. And astrologers will tell you that another 28-year learning cycle begins. So, if you're before the age of 28, the beginning of your Saturn return, the mantra is, Om Shaneshcharaya Namaha. Om Shaneshcharaya Namaha. Om Shaneshcharaya Namaha. After the age of 28, the energy in the body shifts a little. In most people, it comes up to the solar plexus. At this point, the ending of the mantra will change from Namaha to Swaha. And because the ending changes, the word before it will also change, and the mantra becomes Om Shaneshwaraya Swaha. Om Shaneshwaraya Swaha. Om Shaneshwaraya Swaha. Now we come to the moon. There are two karmic nodes of the moon that astrologers will tell you about. They call them Dragon's Head and Dragon's Tail, the North Node and the South Node. In Sanskrit, these are called Rahu and Ketu. And here are their short mantras. Rahu. Om Rahuve Namaha. Om Rahuve Namaha. Om Rahuve Namaha. Dragon's Head. And now, Dragon's Tail, Ketu. Om Ketuve Namaha. Om Ketuve Namaha. Om Ketuve Namaha. So these are mantras for the planets that you can use if you know what difficulties may exist in your astrological natal chart. But what if you don't know? Well, there's a series of stanzas called the Navagraha Pida. And these are stanzas designed to soften your planetary karma. And I will chant them for you as a meditation for easing your planetary karma, as they were intended to do and have done for these many thousands of years.
Navagraha Pida Grahana Mari Raditya Loka Rakshaha Karakaha Vishwamastana Sambhutam Pidam Hartame Ravihi Rohini Shaha Sutamurti Sudha Gatraha Sindashanaha Vishwamastana Sambhutam Pidam Hartame Viduhu Bhumiputro Mahateja Jagatam Vayakritsada Vristi Krudusti Hratacham Pidam Hartame Kujaha Utpata Rupi Jagatam Chandra Putro Mahadvihi Surya Priya Karu Vidyam Kidam Harutume Buddhaha Deva Mantri Vishalakshaha Sada Loka Hitarataha Anika Shisha Sampunaha Pidam Harutume Guruhu Daita Mantri Rusteshayam Pranasya Mahamatihi Prabhusta Agrahanamcha Pidam Harutume Bruhu Surya Putro Dirgadeho Vishalakshaha Shiva Priya Dirga Charaha Prasanatma Pidam Hartume Shanihi Maha Shisho Maha Bhaktro Digadumstro Mahabalaha Atuscho Urdva Keshchaha Pidam Hartume Shiti Anika Rupa Varnischa Shetra Shutra Sahasraha Utpata Rupi Jagatam Pidam Hartume Tamaha Iti Navagraha Pida Parihara Stotram Sampurnam.
May this stotra ease and reduce your planetary karma and make your path smoother, clearer, and more light on the way. A proactive way to approach your own karmic planetary difficulties, if you know what they are from your chart, is to pick one of the planetary mantras and do it in a meditation for, say, 108 times. You might sit, Om Suryaya Namaha, Om Suryaya Namaha, Om Suryaya Namaha. Or you might say, I'm going to chant this now for 5 minutes. And you can work with any of these planetary mantras at any time in those ways. So by saying these various mantras, you have a tool to work with karmic reduction. In that sense, you can take your fate in your own hands, and you can change the outcome. That which is written can be unwritten through your discipline with Sanskrit mantra. We've talked about mantras, seed mantras, planetary mantras, and how they can reduce karma. So what kind of structure can we place them in where we can use them on a regular basis? You heard me say earlier that you could chant a mantra for 108 times. The Hindu rosary is called a mala. Actually, Hindu and Buddhist rosary is called a mala. It has 108 beads. The Catholic rosary has 54 beads and would be called a half mala in Sanskrit. In any case, both of these are convenient mechanisms for counting the number of mantras that you do. and they've been used this way for thousands of years. So one approach to spiritual discipline is to say, I'm going to do this mantra for 40 days, and I'm going to do it for 108 times in the morning and 108 times at night. And so you mark your calendar and you get your rosary. Now, some people like to have a personal altar with a candle and maybe a photo or something. This is entirely optional. It's not necessary, but if it appeals to you, then by all means use it. Find a quiet place where you can perform your mantra meditation at the same place every day. You begin to build energy in the place where you do your spiritual disciplines. So you have your rosary, you have your mala, and you begin your repetition. Om Suryaya Namaha, Om Suryaya Namaha, or whatever it may be, for 40 days. The number 40 is significant in Far Eastern spiritual disciplines, and for several thousand years has been given as the length of time for a formal spiritual discipline. So that's why the number 40 is routinely prescribed by teachers from the Far East for a spiritual discipline lasting a number of days. Now, in the 40 days, you can decide, I'll do it 108 in the morning or 108 at night. Or you can approach it in another way altogether. You can decide that during that 40 days, you'll say the mantra as much as possible. You'll say it from the time you get up till the time you go to bed at night. You can decide that if you're with people or in a situation where you can't chant it out loud, you'll chant it silently. You can do it while cooking, while washing dishes, while driving the car, while mowing the lawn. You can be working with your mantra and decide that you want to approach your structured discipline that way instead. Either way will give you results. Each of us have different stations in life, different sets of responsibilities. So pick the way which resonates best with you, and then be diligent. Don't miss a day. Continue on for the entire 40 days. If it gets a little intense, say it a little less, but don't miss a day. Complete the entire 40 days of your spiritual discipline. This is a powerful technique, both for eliminating karmic conditions through the use of planetary mantras, and for bringing things into your life that you want to see manifest using mantras for some of the principles that we discussed earlier and that we'll be discussing in subsequent portions of this course. One small distinction between saying the mantra all of the time and using your rosary or mala. When you're using the rosary or mala, I recommend that you sit quietly in one place and focus your mind and use the mala as your meditation aid and as your spiritual counter. Then you can decide to either keep the mala in a safe place there, or you can wear it, either outside or inside of your clothes, where the vibrations will be ever with you. What I do not recommend is that you go through your daily activities holding your mala in one hand and mumbling as you try to mow the lawn. I don't think you'll find that that will produce the kind of result that you wish. You certainly might get some interesting looks, though. On the main, if you're going to do your mantra all the time, do it mentally or quietly without a mala. And when you use your mala, sit quietly in one place. Sometimes you may find that there's more than one planet or more than one principle that you'd like to work with at the same time. There are a couple of ways you can approach that. Say there are three planets. You can decide you'll do one in the morning, one sometime in the middle of the day, and one at the end of the day. Another way you can approach it is to decide to do one for a week, and then another one for another week, and then another one for a third week, so that you have a 21-day discipline that you've established for yourself. If you feel ambitious, you can make it a 20-20-20 and a 60-day discipline. So knowing yourself, your time requirements, you can construct a spiritual discipline that will be effective and also suit your conditions. When you practice, you will find that your mind begins to become more concentrated. You become able to think more clearly. You may also find that you have some kinds of spiritual experiences. The range of these experiences is so broad and so different for different kinds of people But here are a few things. You may begin to have what some call subtle sight. You may see auras around people. You may have vivid dreams in which you have pieces of information given to you. You may develop a keener sense of hearing and hear various frequencies or tones or even music. I recommend that you keep a spiritual diary, because some of these things will be very meaningful, and then we forget. But if you keep a spiritual diary and write even just a few lines every day, you'll be amazed years later at what you have on file. I can tell you, having practiced it myself, that I have at times kept the diary and at times not kept the diary. And going back and reviewing my diary from 15 and 20 years ago, I found wonderful things that I had been taught that I had long since forgotten. So I recommend keeping a spiritual diary most highly.
Mantra, Sacred Words of Power, Session 4, Narayana and Brahma Mantras.
So far we've covered seed sounds, what mantras are, how they work, and we've talked about a few short mantras. From here forward, we're going to move into a deeper study of mantras and their application, both spiritually and for our worldly problems. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about how we're going to approach it. For thousands of years, the study of mantras have been taught by examining certain deities and principles, and the stories and myths that surround those deities and principles. And it has provided a good path to learn about mantras, because the stories and the myths make abstract concepts easier to understand and easier to remember. And the deities and the principles provide a ready table of organization. And in a practical sense, if you have some area of your life where there is a problem, more than likely one of the principles or the deities will have associated with it a mantra or a set of mantras that apply specifically to the problem that you have. And so you won't have to go searching about. They'll all be right there. As I said at the beginning, these Hindu deities are widely regarded as anthropomorphized principles. That is to say, they have made a person out of a body of philosophy, masculine person, feminine person, and surrounded them with myths and stories that make the teachings easier to recall. So we're going to cover such concepts as Brahma, the creator of the universe, Vishnu, and the principle of preservation that has come as many masters and teachers. We're going to talk about Shiva, the very consciousness of the universe, and the idea that everything is conscious. We're also going to talk about the great feminine trinity. It's interesting that in the Eastern wisdom, there is not just a masculine trinity, but a feminine one, and we'll talk about that. So from this point forward, we're going to be talking about mythological figures. We're going to be talking about great principles, beings that wander around the universe. And remember that this has all been created to give you an easier way to remember both the philosophy and the mantras, and the power that lies behind both of these. We're going to start off by talking about Brahma, the creator. Brahma is the creative principle of the universe. And the way we're going to start is by going to modern physics. In physics, the monoblock theory of creation is widely held. The monoblock theory simply says that originally, all of the matter in the known universe was concentrated into a single block in one location. And because of this tremendous concentration of force and matter and energy in one place, there was an explosion of such magnitude that it's difficult for us to comprehend it. That explosion flung matter in all directions, and that eventually cooled and became the galaxies and the star clusters that we know today. Now, given the laws of physics as we currently understand them, there will be a time when those galaxies and all that matter that was generated and flung about by that huge explosion will come to rest. Now, this is interesting stuff, but you may have observed that there's something missing from all this, and that is a question. Where did the monoblock come from? From where came this original colossal hunk of energy and matter that coalesced and exploded? The answer is, we don't know. Modern physics has not been able yet to speculate with any reasonableness on the apparent spontaneous generation of that original mass of energy and matter. Some speculate that in a realm composed of antimatter, some has bleeded into our universe and then exploded. But that's conjecture. We do not know for certain. Very interestingly, the East has a simple way of explaining where this monoblock came from. And they do it through the myth and legend of a being called Narayana. Narayana. So take a trip with me, if you will, into a realm that is beyond the laws of physics as we know them. It is beyond the mind of humanity, beyond the ken of any save possibly the most spiritually advanced. And there's a reality that is described in storybook, pictorial terms. A sea of inky blackness, and in it lies a being sleeping. The slumber represents a reality that it occupies, which is completely removed from us and the reality that we know. As it lies there, it represents the beingness, as it were, of God, that from which all of this has sprung. But because it is sleeping, it is not yet manifest. We are not even a cosmic divine idea in the mind of God. So from that beingness, next comes mind. And the way that mind manifests is as a flower which grows from the navel of this sleeping being. It is still sleeping. And as the flower sprouts, a four-headed being emerges that is part of the Vedic masculine trinity called Brahma the Creator. Brahma the Creator. Now, in the Far East, consciousness is described as masculine, and power is described as feminine. Now, we know that fire and its power to burn are interlinked. But in the East, they separate them so that we know that the idea of fire is one thing and the power is another. So here is Brahma as cosmic mind. But now he needs to create. He has a desire. To enact the desire, he needs then the power to create. And the power is feminine. So immediately appears with him Saraswati, his feminine side, part of the feminine trinity that accompanies the masculine trinity. She is his power to create, and she creates through the word. So returning to modern physics, the monoblock itself was created by Brahma, and the explosion that caused it to be flung across the universe was the power of Saraswati through the divine word. Now the word is a far-flung representation of what we know as mantra. In that realm where that takes place, there is one form of divine speech called Vach. When it filters down to the human level and we have our application of divine speech, it is known as Sanskrit mantra. So we have Narayana sleeping. We have Brahma emerging from his navel. We have accompanying Brahma Saraswati, his power. The universe is then created. And the known laws of physics, as we understand them, come into being. From the standpoint of the Vedic myths, there is still a reality beyond all of the known universe that we occupy and see through our telescopes. And according to those same myths, this entire reality is a dream, as it were, in the mind of God. Now, once the universe is underway, as it were, Brahma decides that he's going to create some other beings as well. And we have scriptures where he says, may I unite with myself, may I propagate, may I be many. And first he creates a class of beings called the Rishis. Rishi simply means a sage or one who understands deep spiritual mysteries. And these Rishis will eventually record the scriptures and the mantras, which are then given to humanity millennia after millennia later, when the galaxies have cooled and planets have been formed and humanity has approached something like its present state, and we get our portion of the divine word, which we know as mantra. As we said a bit ago, Brahma is really a name for this entire cosmos with all of its contents. And one who has become one with it, the cosmos, becomes a Brahma Rishi. And a Brahma Rishi is one of the highest states of consciousness that one can attain while still living in a human body. So now I'm going to give you a mantra that will help one along the path of understanding divine knowledge, how the universe works from a spiritual standpoint. This is a mantra that highly advanced spiritual teachers give their very advanced students if they are both on the path of knowledge. Here is the mantra. Sat Chid Ekam Brahma. Sat Chid Ekam Brahma. Sat Chit Ekam Brahma. Sat means truth. Chid means spiritual mind stuff. Ekam means one without a second, that is a unitary one, only one. And Brahma, this entire cosmos with all of its contents. So you see, the mantra at first glance is the truth of the universe realized by the mind and perceived as a unitary whole without a second. Sat Chid Ekam Brahma. Sat Chid Ekam Brahma. Sat Chid Ekam Brahma. So for those of you who are trotting the path of knowledge, you know there are those among us who just want to know as much as they can. The drive for knowledge and understanding overpowers every other drive. And these are the potential rishis and sages among us. And for those with that bent of mind, this is a wonderful mantra because it helps them pursue the directions of their mind in which it is naturally tending to flow anyway. Sat Chid Ekam Brahma, the sublime truths of the universe. Sat Chid Ekam Brahma. Because the universe is unitary in the Vedic sense, this mantra is also excellent for scholars, scientists, philosophers, and those pursuing the mysteries in whatever way they may approach those. So in the worldly sense, this is a great mantra for those at the university who are pursuing great truths in their particular area of interest. Now I'm going to complicate things a little bit for you. The supercharger for the mantra is to add the feminine power. And the feminine power is in the form of seed mantras that we talked about earlier. Now you remember Om is the seed sound for the brow center, where we have unitary state of consciousness, you'll recall. You remember we talked about I'm. This is that Saraswati seed sound, Saraswati, which produces education and good memory and the power of rapid thought and of understanding, the power behind these things. So we add this seed sound to the mantra. Remember Hrim, where we talked about Hrim, the seed sound that dissolves this apparent reality? We throw that in. Then Shrim, the idea of abundance. Because if we may know and if we may understand, we want it to be abundant, not just dry, but we want the abundance attached to it as well. And then Kleem, we're attracting all of that. And then we come to a new word, Saw. Saw is like a switch that opens the power to the generator, making things to turn. Now, Sat Chit Ekam Brahma, you will remember. So now we have taken the mantra and put it in the shaker and added ice and stirred it up, and we've made more of a mantra cocktail by adding the seed sounds. Here's how the mantra now sounds. Om Aim Hreem Shreem Kleem Sa Sat Chit Ekam Brahma. Om Aim Hreem Shreem Kleem Sa Sat Chit Ekam Brahma. So for all of you out there who, either in a worldly sense or a spiritual sense, want to understand the great mysteries of this life and this universe, this is your mantra. Now that you have a Brahma mantra you can work with, let's return to the idea of Brahma as the creator of the universe. We saw it emerge from Narayana's lotus, and therefore it has a beginning. Now we know what has a beginning has an end. So implied within the emergence of Brahma from Narayana's lotus as the known universe, it's going to have a duration, a cycle of time, and then it's going to be over. And this is entirely consistent with the laws of physics as we understand them. So Brahma in the spiritual sense coincides completely with Brahma in the scientific sense, in that the universe, as Brahma, has a known lifespan. Astonishingly, in the Vedas of the East, they tell you in considerable detail what the lifespan of the universe is, what its various cycles are, and they do it in a framework that we understand. Time. So, a day of Brahma is 4,320,000,000 years, followed by a night of equal length, and then 360 of those days is called 1 year of Brahma, and 100 of those constitute the life of Brahma. So we have the life of the universe from the Vedic perspective as 311,040,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, wheels. It's like this great cosmic watch. There are little small wheels that are going around very quickly, and little larger wheels that are turning a little slower, and then larger wheels which are turning very slowly. Let's talk about those wheels and the cycles of time they represent. The solar system takes, are you ready, 4,320,000 years to revolve around this other center in the galaxy. So here we have the solar system, and to go make one revolution, 4,320,000 years. But as it makes its trip, it has seasons, just as the Earth has seasons and climates. But these seasons are measured not in temperature, but in consciousness. In summer, 90% of the inhabitants of the Earth are enlightened. In autumn and fall, it falls to about 10%. And in winter, it moves, sadly, to less than 1%. Where are we now? Well, I've got good news and I've got bad news. I'll give you the bad news first. We are 5,000 years into winter, which will last 432,000 years. Now here's the good news. There is a shorter 24,000-year cycle, and we have just entered spring in that cycle. So while things are getting worse on the big scale, they're getting quite a bit better on the small scale, so not to worry, things will be fine for about the next 8,000 years. So with the study of Brahma, the Vedic rishis have given us a complete cosmology of the known universe, the time for its various phases of existence, and its time for its total existence. And since we've talked about the idea of time, maybe it's time to talk about a mantra which relates to time. I'm going to move to a story about the Buddha, although we'll talk about him more in much more detail when we talk about the avatars of Vishnu. This story about the Buddha applies here. Now, There's no way of knowing whether this story is completely factual or whether it's apocryphal. It's probably a mixture of both. With that in mind, here's the Buddha on his deathbed. The watch and the vigil for his passing has begun. One by one, small groups of people leave. And finally, there is only a handful remaining. Suddenly, the Buddha emerges from his coma-like state and says, "Oh yes, I have a final teaching." And it becomes the Kala Chakra teaching. So among the people that were seated there when he began this teaching was a king from Tibet. And all the people made copious notes, and then when the Buddha passed, they went on their way. The king returned to Tibet. Over the ensuing years, invasions of India from the north destroyed many of the sets of the teachings of most of the people who had taken notes surrounding the Buddha at the time of his passing. Interestingly, the only complete set of notes about the Kala Chakra teachings, therefore, lay in Tibet, where for centuries they were kept, safeguarded, put into a set of doctrines, and passed on from teacher to student up until the present day. Today in the United States, the Kala Chakra discipline is taught by a number of teachers, but most principally by the Dalai Lama, who is given the empowerment of the mantra and the principles several times across the country. Now, the Kala Chakra teaching involves a mantra, and the mantra runs like this. Om Haksa Malavarayam Swaha. Om Haksa Malavarayam Swaha. And if you refer to the booklet that accompanies this program, you'll see the mantra clearly written there. The Kala Chakra teaching is primarily a teaching of Tibetan Buddhism. However, several years ago, I was browsing through a text written by Arthur Avalon, which is a pseudonym of the eminent Sir John Woodruff, called The Tantra of Great Liberation. And in the beginning, he describes the chakras in great detail that are in the body. And in one place, in passing, he notes a small esoteric chakra located just below the fifth chakra, just below the notch of the neck, which he calls the Kala Chakra, the Wheel of Time. So the Hindus are aware of it, but the Buddhists have the complete set of teachings. But the Kala Chakra is the chakra within the body related to time. So if you work with this mantra, you are going to understand the phenomenon of time. I do not understand the phenomenon of time, therefore I cannot tell you what the final result will be. And it will be different for different people. But I can report to you that I know a woman who has worked with the mantra extensively. And whenever she's running late, she says this mantra, and she says, "You know, I end up always being on time." Om Haksa Malavarayam Swaha. Om Haksa Malavarayam Swaha. But this mantra has other applications besides understanding the phenomenon of time. The vehicle of spiritual development, as we've talked about, are the chakras located along the spine in the body, the activation of those. This mantra helps purify those chakras, and therefore is one of the great mantras for perfection of the divine vehicle. Now, that sounds like a complicated phrase, but it's not. This body is the vehicle of our consciousness, and the chakras process the energy for the vehicle. So as you work with mantras that purify the chakras, you are engaged in what is called perfection of the divine vehicle. So this mantra is a very powerful means of speeding your spiritual evolution by purifying the chakras themselves and thus making rapid spiritual progress. So let's break down the syllables of the mantra one by one. Om, you remember, is the seed sound for the brow center. Now, this is the Tibetan interpretation of these various sounds. Haksa petals of the sixth chakra at the brow center. Ma is the Sanskrit sound for the energy running down the left side of the body. La, va, ra are seed sounds for the first, second, and third chakra. You've learned them so far as lum, vum, rum, and this is a variation, la, va, ra. Yum, seed sound for the fourth chakra at the heart center, and swaha in this sense means everything above, so everything above the heart. So, functionally, the mantra is seed sound, petals of the chakra at the sixth center located in the forehead, then energy running down the left side, then first, second, third, fourth chakra, then everything above. So you're centering the energy at the sixth center. Remember we talked about when the consciousness has moved to the sixth chakra, you have perception of the universe as a unitary whole, and you have moved beyond the pairs of opposites. So when you completely purify the divine vehicle, you then really see no conflict in the universe. It's an organic thing all unto itself, and you understand your relationship to it, with it, and as part of it. And by another means, you've come to understand the unified whole, which is Brahma, this entire cosmos. And because Brahma has a concrete existence, you'll understand the unified principle of Brahma through the concept of time. Now you might ask, why is the Dalai Lama teaching this mantra? Why did the Buddha give that mantra in the first place? All I can do is tell you a very interesting story about the mantra and where those who practice it end up. It runs something like this. At an indeterminate period in the future, that some place as 250 years, some place as 500 or 700 years, somewhere between there, the mean average is about 350, there will be born on earth an evil figure of such power that he subdues and conquers all of the various governments and kingdoms on the earth one by one. At that point, he will think he has conquered the entire world. But of course, he has not. At that point, a small spiritual kingdom known as Shambhala, located in the Himalayas, will suddenly be visible. Now, there are myths about Shambhala. Some say it's a hidden kingdom that exists in the physical and hasn't been found. Others say that it exists in an etheric realm and not a physical realm at all. Doesn't matter. Ultimately, what happens is, here's this kingdom, Shambhala, and the evil king says, there's one more battle to fight, one more kingdom to defeat. What he does not know is that the king of Shambhala is a bodhisattva, a fully enlightened being, and that his army is also of highly developed spiritual adepts. So the bodhisattva comes out of his city, leading his army, and his general, and even the name of the general has been given in the scripture surrounding the story, and his name is Hanumanda. So the bodhisattva, with his general Hanumanda, and his army come out, and they defeat the evil king who has overrun the earth. Now, the army is composed of people who have chanted this mantra. Om Haksa Malavarayam Swaha. Om Haksa Malavarayam Swaha. So that in the teachings of the mantra today, they say that if you chant this mantra, you will be reborn in Shambhala at the time when this great battle will be fought. And all of those who fight in this battle will be liberated by the bodhisattva. So great is his spiritual authority. So in that sense, this mantra becomes a liberation mantra, or that which frees one from the round of rebirth and achieves that thing we talked about earlier called mukti, or liberation. So chant this mantra to understand this cosmos and to understand time. And also chant this mantra so that you too may achieve liberation. So by becoming liberated from this universe, we then have an opportunity to go back to our source, and we're back to Narayana again. We've talked about Narayana and this being called Brahma that springs from the navel lotus. And from that, this entire cosmos is born. And within each and every one of us, still, there is a piece of this great being from which this universe itself has come. To take this in a very personal way, let's focus in on that piece of Narayana, that piece of divinity within. Some call it the soul, some call it Atman, it goes by many names. Here we are relating to it as Narayana, the flame of truth burning in the center of the heart. There's an ancient hymn about this being that we'll use as a meditation. So as with usual meditations, you may sit comfortably and quietly, remove the shoes or anything that's constrictive, or if you want, lie down on the floor, on the couch, and get comfortable. And let's go through this. We're going to meditate on Narayana, that part of ourselves that is infinite consciousness, self-effulgent, although separate, never parted from God, the Supreme, that which created this entire cosmos, and whose essence is both within us and outside of the universe, all at once, seemingly far away, but really close at hand, and the substance of all that we know as reality. In Sanskrit, Hari Om Sahasra Shirsham Devam Vishvaksham Vishvashambhavam Vishvam Narayanam Devam Aksharam Paramam Param Vishvataha Paramanityam Vishwam Narayanam Harim Vishwame Vedam Parushta Vishwamu Vajivati Patim Vishwat Mishwaram Shashwatam Shivam Achyutam Narayanam Mahadneyam Vishwatmanam Parayanam Narayanam Param Brahma Tatvam Narayana Paraha Narayana Paro Jyotir Atma Narayana Paraha Narayana Paro Jata Dhyanam Narayana Paraha. Let the sound of the Sanskrit play through your chakras. We don't have to understand. All we have to do is experience its effect. Whatever we see, whatever we hear, it is the cosmic essence of Narayana that pervades all of it. In a budding lotus, at our sacred heart, just below the heart chakra, burns a flame. Surrounded by a tableau of small flames, burns this large, indestructible flame. It activates the solar plexus, where the digestive fire is. Its light illumines the consciousness where the mind operates. And yet, it is itself an indestructible, our own self. And when we identify with it, we identify with the entire universe. Yet chikinjit jagat sarvam dushute shruyute piva antar barhischa Tatsarvam vipya narayana stitaha antatam avyayam kavin samudrindam vishvashambhavam padma kosha pratikasham hridayam chapyudho mukham addho nischa vitansyante nabhyam uparitistati jvala mala kulam bhati vishvasayatatam mahat santatam shailabistulam vatya kosha sannibam tasyante sushiram sukshman tasmin sarvam pratisthitam tasye madhye mahanagnir vishvachir vishvatok mukaha sagrabugvi bajantishtam aharama jaraha kavihi tirya gurtva madhyashaye rashmayascha santata santapayati swam dehama paratalamastagaha tasya madhye vanashika aniyodvastita tasya madhye vanashika aniyodva vivastitaha nila tayoda madhyasta vidyuleka vavasvara nivara shukatanve pita vasyatanupapa tasya shikaya madhye paramatma vivastitaha sa brahma sa shivaha sa harihi sindra sukshara paramaha saratatu.
At our essence, we are indestructible. We are omnipresent. We are ever in union with that which created this entire cosmos. Our indwelling spirit is one with God at all times.
Om namo narayanaya vidmehe vasudevaya dhimihi tanno vishnum prachodayat. Om namo narayanaya vidmehe vasudevaya dhimihi tanno vishnum prachodayat. Om namo narayanaya vidmehe vasudevaya dhimihi tanno vishnum prachodayat.
So as you sit or lay quietly, watching the breath go in and out, and in and out, know that Narayana is your own divine self. Know that you are indestructible, immortal, transcending space and time. You are Narayana. Your essence has created this entire cosmos. And sit in perfect peace and harmony with your own divine self as you watch the breath go in and out, and in and out. You are Narayana. You are the truth of that flame. Amen.